We have such a great roster of gardening experts that spend time with us on Garden Talk. And I know that one of your favorites is Melinda Myers, and she's a Milwaukee-based garden expert, the author of more than 20 books, and she's also the host of Melinda's Garden Moments. And we love it when she joins us, and she's with us today. Melinda, hi.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
I'm great. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, and like most gardeners that have been lucky enough to get a few showers lately, feeling much better about the growing season, even though we've still got some drought conditions in many areas. At least a little bit of water is sure helping out.
Oh, it made just a world of difference. Not only the flowers and the veggies, the lawns.
Exactly. You can. It's amazing, isn't it? We all know how important water is, and you can water, but boy, a good rain fall sure takes away a lot of the stress. So hopefully some of our farmers got it just in time, or at least suffering a little less.
Yeah, and I think, well, I want to mention trees and shrubs a little bit, just because even though we've had that rain, your trees may still need moisture.
Oh, you bet. You know, I think we often think, you know, I gave a talk recently where we were talking drought, of course, and somebody said, well, the trees are looking fine. Well, some have dropped a lot of leaves. Some are showing scorch. Some aren't showing the signs of stress yet, but next year they're more likely to be hit by insect and disease. And the following year, after the drought of 88, we really saw a lot of borer damage and insect problems and tree decline because of the drought, but the impact was felt for several years. So you're absolutely right. Thorough soaking, you know, sandy soils once a week, every 10 days, maybe more often if we, you know, this heat seems to be continuing.
Yeah.
But that's an investment we've made. That's 20, 30, 50, 100, 200 years, you can't replace that with a new plant.
No, you can't. Joya in Fitchburg has a question for you, so let's go to her. Hi, Joya.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Sorry. I have a question for her. Mm-hmm. I have some, like all the plants, all the bushes are stressed out, you know, this year. And funny thing is, some of the asters, which bloom usually in the fall, they are blooming now.
Yeah,
you know. Do you know the explanation for this? And another one is, what should I do about feeding the roses? Because I usually feed them in July, and in the first week of July is the last feed I give. And this year, because of the drought, we just have been watering, and I was told not to feed them anymore.
Yeah, here's a couple things, and let's kind of go down the list. In terms of bloom, I just gave a walk at Berner Botanical Gardens, our botanic garden in the Milwaukee area, and we were laughing because we do walks throughout the year, and we saw a lot of fall bloomers already doing their thing. Things bloom and mature for certain reasons, like tomatoes and peppers. You know, when we have a warm, sunny summer, your tomatoes, peppers, if they set fruit, it hasn't been too hot, they start to mature based on accumulation of temperatures, much like insects. Some plants are photoperiodic, meaning as the days shorten and fall, they set bloom. And then some plants, when they're under stress, whether it's drought or cold or, you know, heat, often set bloom. So we're seeing a lot of those fall bloomers that bloom because we've had just this huge accumulation of heat, some because of stress. My feeling is enjoy it because...
Yeah.
Fall's going to be an interesting thing. If you've watered your plants, another good reason for watering trees, besides the most important survival, is fall color is influenced by the health and vigor of trees. So when we have a droughty fall, we usually don't have as good, magnificent fall color as well. So weather conditions, you know, and then you tuck in all those reasons they bloom. Okay, Larry, we're going to have
feeding roses, we've got.
Feeding roses, okay. Good advice, if you're using a high nitrogen quick release fertilizer during drought, you just increase the chance of burning and damaging plants. We're getting to that window too where we want to do our last feeding in July. Fertilizing later in the season can stimulate late season growth. So if your plants aren't showing the need for nutrients, I wouldn't fertilize. Using a low nitrogen slow release fertilizer, something like a Milorganite, won't burn your plants. But, you know, always gauge whether your plants need those nutrients. So if they look like they're thriving and doing fine, I would hold off and do a spring fertilization. If you feel they need a nutrient boost, then use something low nitrogen, slow release. If we, you know, it sounds like we're headed for some hot weather again next week, you want to make sure you're not going to damage the plants.
There we go. Thanks, Joya, for calling. Appreciate your call. Rose in Menominee Falls, your turn. Hi, Rose.
Rose, hey, Rose, can I help you?
Rose, are you there? Well, we guess we lost Rose. Let us try Ben in Waupaca then. Hi, Ben.
Good morning, Ben.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I got a question about cutworms. This year, I pretty much my whole vegetable garden got devastated by the cutworms. And I have chickens, and I'd like to incorporate them in the garden because I do a good job at scratching and pecking and fertilizing the garden. Do you have any tips on how to have the chickens in the garden, but at the same time not having them eat your seedlings as they're popping up or scratching and destroying what you have already growing?
You know, I saw this really interesting chicken coop weeding contraption in Oklahoma a couple years ago at the Garden Writers Conference, and they had the chicken coop with a walk that went around the garden that was fenced, and then they could open up and let the chickens in to do the weeding and pecking once the plants were established or as needed. So it wasn't a free-range kind of thing in the garden, and they could control it. Whether that will help, I'm not sure, because you really need to get them down early with the problem with cutworms. Cutworms are usually a problem on new gardens that have been transformed from grass into garden. That's usually where we see the biggest problem. Cutworm collars really are very effective. And I don't know if it's practical for you, but maybe for others listening, Ben. Taking like a tuna can, a soap, a soup can, cutting the top and bottom, and then just sinking it an inch below the ground and letting it go at least an inch above the ground around your transplants. That prevents the cutworm from getting up, crawling around, and munching through. So for people with just a few plants, that's very effective, especially if you don't want to use a pesticide, which I find usually once that garden's been growing and you do good sanitation, not a problem. Chickens, I'm going to be really honest, it's kind of a new area for me. And I don't know, Larry, if you've had any guests that talk about chickens in the garden, and since it's becoming more and more popular and legal to have chickens in an urban environment, there's a lot more coming out with chicken farming in an urban area. So that might be Phil, I'm going to dump this on Phil when Phil's on.
Well, we haven't really discussed it. The downside of it is for a vegetable garden in particular, I'm not sure you want fresh chicken manure.
Good point.
Around crops
that you high nitrogen, right?
Well, and then also just the cleanliness thing too. So there's some issues there. But
good point. I'm glad you jumped in on that one.
But otherwise, we'll dump it on Phil.
Okay. He was my friend, maybe not so much anymore.
Oh, thanks.
Sorry, Ben. Well, good luck, and if you come up with a solution, or find some resources, I speak in Seattle every year, and I talk to a lot of the goat folks and the chicken folks, so I'll see if they have any insights they can share, and I'll be sure to bring them back next spring.
All right, thanks, Ben, for calling. All right, now let's go to Rose in Menominee Falls. Rose, hi.
Hi there.
Hi, Rose.
Hi. I have a question. I have two hydrangea plants I've had for 3 or 4 years, and they've bloomed. And this year, they're full, they're healthy, they're beautiful. I have no blooms.
Do you know what kind of hydrangeas these are?
No, I know you were going to ask that. And the only thing I can tell you, in years past, I do not cut mine back in the fall. I let them go through the winter, and in the spring I cut back the dead parts, and they've always bloomed very well. This last year, our condo gardeners got to the plants before I could get them, and they cut them down last fall. And
are they pink or blue flowers or white?
They were blue, and now they're mostly pink.
Pink, okay. So, how long ago did you buy those, do you think? A couple years?
Probably 3 years ago.
Okay. Probably endless summer. Here's the thing. The pink and blue hydrangeas are a group of hydrangeas. They're blue in acid soil, as you probably know, and pink in alkaline soil. They typically bloom on old wood, like the Nikko series. And so what happens in Wisconsin is they often die back to the ground. And we prune them back to the ground like our white ones, they send up new growth, they're beautiful leaves, no flowers. With those, we want to try to preserve at least some of the old growth, because the growth that comes off any stems, and it sounds like that's what you did in the past, where you waited, saw what survived, cut the dead, the new growth from the old stems produces flowers. Now, Endless Summer was introduced about, I think it was 6 years ago maybe already, and it's supposed to bloom on old and new wood. Now, a lot of people have not had great success, and what I find is if you give them sufficient moisture in the spring and a little bit of fertilizer in the spring, then you'll get good bloom, you know, low nitrogen, slow release, because you don't want to push leaf growth at the expense of flowers. That's a possibility. So if you had an older one by chance that does bloom on old growth, you're right. If they cut it right back to the ground, they eliminated the flowering wood. If it's the Endless Summer, you know, moisture, you know, a good moisture, especially spring and early summer. And then if you haven't fertilized, try next spring, not now, but next spring, you know, putting a little bit of Milorganite around it or some other low nitrogen, slow release. Milorganite also releases phosphorus in the soil that's bound in the soil, so you get that little boost for flowering as well. But that should help. So it might be a combination of lack of moisture, maybe a little nutrients needed if it's Endless Summer. Otherwise, try to get to the the landscaper and keep them off the plants.
Yes.
Yes, they will.
I know, and it's always challenging.
A possibility or probability that they will come back and flower again?
Oh, yeah. Definitely. It's not
next year.
It's not a problem for ever. It's just for this year.
Okay.
So just, you know, try to keep them from pruning it back to the ground, watching the moisture, and then a little fertilizer next spring. If it's Endless Summer, it should still bloom. But, you know, it was a pretty dry winter, so it didn't have enough moisture. That seems to affect their bloom if it's Endless Summer as well.
Thanks, Rose.
Thank you.
Good luck with that.
Leanne in Heartland. Hi.
Hi, Larry and Melinda.
Hi, Leanne. How are you?
I'm good, and I'm looking forward to seeing you at State Fair.
Well, thank you. We'll put an equal plug in, if you don't mind, Larry. The Master Gardeners do a great garden in the DNR area, and the DNR has a great display, and Leanne's one of the excellent Master Gardeners that staffs that. And I'll be at We Energy Energy Park every day speaking. So
that is really cool.
Isn't it? Yeah, it's a fun garden. We've had marriage proposals there, and, you know, because it's just this little beautiful oasis.
I love that.
Yeah.
I love that spot.
Anyway, sorry, Leanne. I'm looking forward to seeing you, too.
Good. I'm making a larger bed in one of my gardens, and I just wondered if you know any newer, unusual plants that I could plant in it.
Yeah, are you looking for perennials?
Pretty much so, yeah.
Yeah, you know, this is funny, I just stopped at the Botanic Garden to buy a few plants for our kids' activities and ran into the gardeners, and Midwest Ground Covers is introducing a brand new allium called Peekaboo. It's a shorter, summer-blooming, round, about 2-inch blue flowers, nice, robust foliage.
Hmm.
Called Peekaboo Allium. They showed me a sample, and I had it in my hands, and the botanical supervisor goes, I'll take that back, please. I know. I was like, ooh, sample. So I'm adding that to my list, and that's a nice blue summer bloomer, a little bit shorter than the cerulean. Probably looks like it's going to be about 14 inches tall. This is brand new to me. That's about all I know, but it looks beautiful, and it's a nice, easy to blend in the garden. Some of the other, well, there's always, is this full sun or some shade?
Mainly shade.
Okay. Well, you know, there's a zillion coral bells and hostas always out there.
Right.
I love the, there's some new alliums. There's a deep red. I'm trying to remember. I just picked it up this spring. I can't remember the cultivar, but it's a really nice deep red flower. That's very good. And then the new bleeding heart that's a deep red is either out now or coming out soon. So watch for that. Can I remember the cultivar name? Of course not.
Yeah.
But check that one out, too. That's a really nice one as well. Kind of going through my list of shade perennials that I've been seeing. Ferns, lots of new introductions with some red stem ferns, just as well as those red hostas. Whiskey sour and cherry berry hostas have red flower stems, which is kind of cool. And so if you're looking for something a little different to add some color and intrigue in your shade garden, that's kind of another fun one, too.
What was that called?
Whiskey sour?
I know. Not the reason I noticed it right away. However, and cherry berry. And cherry berry, the flower.
I've got that one.
Yeah,
it's
beautiful. Isn't it gorgeous?
Yeah, right.
So, off the top of my head, that's kind of what I'm thinking. But I'm going to Garden Writers this fall, so I may have some new varieties that I'll definitely share with you. And maybe when I'm on in spring, Larry, we can maybe focus on kind of some of the new stuff, or this fall, some of the new plants that are being introduced.
You were talking about alliums, and I was just hearkening back or thinking back to the Hampton Court Flower Show.
I saw your picture. Oh.
And we had the alliums. There were some of the most spectacular allium I've ever seen in my life. That was really a lot of fun.
I was very excited for you. I have to admit, I've never done the gardens in England, so that's on my bucket list. And
you got to do it. It really
great.
Was a lot of fun.
Sounds wonderful.
Leanne, thank you.
Thanks a lot, Leanne. We'll see at the fair.
Mm-hmm. Thanks a lot. And you're on every day?
I'm on every day at 9:45 and 2, talking about garden renewal. So we're doing some really fun things. Renewing parts of the garden. We had some drought stress plants from last year that were struggling. We used Jazz Plant Strengthener to give them a boost. We're doing some of those shoe holder pocket holders. We've made them into planters, some bag planters. So we're doing fun things, bowling ball art, So hummingbird feeders from Birds in Bloom out of recycled bottles. So just some fun things that hopefully you'll join me. I talk for about a half an hour, 40 minutes, answer questions until they kick me out. And then we do kids' activities at 11:15 every day.
Oh, man.
And we don't kick any kids out that are over 12 either, let me tell you. So we've had a few tall children older than me, so they're welcome, too. We're making terrariums out of water bottles for recycling.
Well, and that every day of the fair. Man, you're a busy gal at week in 9 days.
Well, it's a fun place to be, isn't it?
Oh, isn't it? I love it. Yeah,
I do, too. So I can spread out my fair enjoyment. A new food every day, a new building every day. Spread those calories out. It's all good.
Absolutely. Melinda Myers, our guest today, talking about plants and flowers, of course, and vegetables. And we get into trees, a little of everything, because she knows so much. Melinda Myers, our guest. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Melinda Myers, our guest on this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. Open line so we can get you on pretty quickly with your question at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. Of course, you can always post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, or send us an email at talk@wpr.org. I do want to get a couple of emails that have come in, Melinda. We've got one from Peggy in Wauwatosa. She says, I have a Kentucky Redbud Volunteer. Any way to nurture it through the winter and possibly move it either now or in the future? It's about 18 inches tall. Looks very healthy. I've seen volunteers in the past, but they never seem to come back, so she wants some tips.
Yeah, redbuds are beautiful, and if you're purchasing one, look for the Columbus, as in Columbus, Wisconsin, the home of the Redbud Festival in early April.
Mm-hmm.
Never been there, but that's also on my bucket list.
Mm-hmm.
Or the Minnesota strain, which was selected for its hardiness in the Twin Cities area. Now, as a gardener, we always love volunteer plants, so a good east-facing location, somewhat protected, should be the eventual home for that seedling. If it's doing great, I would leave it as is. You may want to give it a little protection if it's out in the open, maybe a cylinder of hardware cloth to keep rabbits from munching on it. You could always throw some evergreen boughs in there, sink that hardware cloth in the ground and higher than your plant. I like to do transplanting in the spring, though this year with the drought and the heat, maybe not even the best time, but then you've got spring and early summer to get it going before winter sets in. After the leaves drop is also the second best time to do transplanting as well. But with the redbud, if you can wait, they're slow to root, so I would do it in spring if possible. And then putting it in a good protected location, morning sun would be great, protected from the northwest winds, and mulch that root you know, the soil surface, not the trunk, to help conserve moisture, keep the weeds and the grass away, and you'll be amazed. So, again, I've had some southern red buds that just kind of died back, and then I'd have a red bud bush for a few years, and they just weren't reliably hardy. So,
yep.
You know, if this is from a hardy plant, you might have some good luck with it. But I think that's part of the fun of gardening is giving it a try.
And an email from Lisa, can you recommend a good all-purpose reference book for perennial gardens? I'm interested in learning about what to deadhead, what to let go to seed, soil conditions for plants, so I don't put one who likes wet next to one who likes dry, not to mention light conditions and fertilizing. Don't be afraid to mention your own book.
Okay. Well, thank you. We'll start there. What I tried to do in my book was take the most common questions that people can't find the answers in most garden books and cover. So my garden book for Wisconsin and month-by-month gardening in Wisconsin are those two together kind of give you the good foundation. Now, for avid gardeners and experienced gardeners, I also recommend Tracy DeSabato Oust, and DeSabato is DeSabato-Aust. Her book, The Well-Tended Perennial Garden, is excellent for maintenance. Now, the reason I don't recommend it for beginners, this is a great book that, you know, you're having trouble that your cone flowers aren't blooming or they're flopping. What do? You look it up and you follow her directions. But if you're brand new and you read the book start to finish, you'd think you needed to be out there all the time. She really helps you take your garden to that next level, doing a lot of the things that you do. I talk about the low maintenance. Here's what you need to do to get good results. She's going to help you take it that next level. So if you've been gardening, you know, you do nothing, it's okay. You can do this tweaking and that tweaking, and it's a lot better. And it's an excellent book. She also has lists in the back of plants that need deadheading, those that don't, things for wet, things for shade. So it's a great reference book, The Well-Tended Perennial Garden. She has a design one as well, which I can't remember the title, but if you get to the perennial garden, you'll find her other ones.
And your books are available pretty much everywhere, but also online at your website, I'm pretty sure.
Right. The Garden Book for Wisconsin and Month by Month Gardening in Wisconsin. And for Minnesota folks, I have the Minnesota versions too. So, it's really about trying to help you be successful and have fun. Because, you know, gardening, it's got challenges, but it should be fun. And we've all killed a few plants. So,
yes,
you know, just join the group.
Yes, we have. Oh,
part
boy.
Part of the process.
Shaden in Madison, let's turn to you now. Hi, thank you for calling.
I have a little water feature.
You have a little water feature? Okay.
And I've collected some moss from some woodsy areas, and I kind of try to put them around there. And they're not really taking. They've been there for about 3 months, and I was just wondering if you might have any suggestions on how to get the moss to kind of take root.
You know, good question. We did a Melinda's Garden Moments on moss gardens, and it is archived on my website. And I'll tell you, the gentleman we featured his yard, Dale, wonderful, Dale Sievert, beautiful. He collects moss from all over. And moss really is somewhat picky on its growing conditions. You know, we think of moss as moist, compacted soil conditions. And so you try to want to find moss, collect moss from areas similar to the growing conditions and soils where you're trying to transplant it. You also might want to try doing a slurry where you won't want to eat at my house, but this is what I did. I took some moss, threw it in a blender, a little bit of beer, a little bit of buttermilk, some water, blended it up and poured it on the soil surface. And when we went to shoot this Melinda's Garden Moment, somebody opened the back of my vehicle where I had my blender with the slurry in it. It broke, and I had moss growing on my bumper for a week. Yes, until the rains came. So it was pretty funny. It was pretty funny.
Oh, man. Well, and now for Melinda's Garden Moments, give that address so that...
If you just go to my website, melindamyers.com, on the right-hand bar, there's a thing for the video and audio tips. So we've archived them all, so if you miss them or it doesn't air in your area, you can check on older versions and see what's coming up and see if it's on stations in your area as well.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, thank you guys so much.
Well, thanks. Good luck, and give that a try, and maybe you want a spare blender to do your mixing.
Thanks a lot for that question and for that call. Appreciate it. John bought his mom a Christmas cactus that bloomed very nicely the first year, but not since. Been 4 years. He bought a new one and did the same thing. Is there a way to get them to bloom again?
Christmas cactus, there's some debate on what forces them to bloom, but everyone pretty much agrees if you run them a little dry and cooler at night especially, that seems to trigger flowering. Some believe that they're photoperiodic, like poinsettias, meaning they need 14 hours of total darkness each night. So if she summers them outside, bring them inside, and then move them to an area where they get dark and cool temperatures at night, and that's a way to initiate bloom. Once the buds have formed, then you can leave them in regular growing conditions. So bright, sunny conditions in the day, cool darkness 14 hours at night, and a little bit drier. Once they're blooming, you can water a little more often. Try to minimize movement, though, once they start flowering because they tend to drop buds. So find that spot where you can enjoy them out of drafts of hot and cold air, and that should really kick them into gear. They also like to be pot-bound, too. So, you know, sometimes we think, okay, we're going to put it in a pot three times bigger just so we never have to do it again.
Yeah.
And your plants then fill up that pot with roots instead of flowering. So keep them slightly pot-bound, and I think you'll be able to kick that back into gear.
Drew in Hudson, hello.
Hi, Drew.
Hi. How are you guys?
Great. Thanks for calling. What can we do for you?
Yeah, I'm looking to restore a field to, like, a native prairie, and there's some good plants out there. There's some good prairie plants, but there's also a lot of junk. I'm wondering who I could contact or if I should do it myself for, like, a burn of that field.
You know, what I would do, and Larry, jump in, because I know you have Neil DeBull on,
yeah,
who owns Prairie Nursery, and he not only sells prairie seed, but he also helps establish prairie gardens. He and his staff are excellent. And I know you may have some other experts on as well, Larry.
Mm-hmm.
Because you've got some good things, some weeds, you know, obviously a burn is going to help take care of some of the weeds. But, you know, it may be a point where you want an expert to come out there and say, you know what, you've got 5% good, 95% bad, and to really get it to start, it might be better to start from scratch, or they may be able to help you, you know, either spot treat, if you don't mind using a total vegetation killer to get the weeds under control. You know, a burn will help, but there's still probably going to be a lot of weed seed in there. So I think investing,
yeah,
up front is going to save you a lot of headaches and money down the road. So I would recommend.
I'd agree with that.
Yeah, and there's a lot of good folks I know, that a couple of different people that come on. But you know, give a call, ask around, tell them your situation, get a feel for it. Do they match your kind of style of gardening and what you're looking for? But it's the same with a landscaper. My favorite gardens are usually those where it's an avid gardener that's had a little advice from a landscape designer. Just kind of helps them avoid some of the problems, get some good design features, and you end up saving a lot more money down the road.
Yep. And Prairie Nursery is a great spot, but there, as you say, there are other places as well.
So, yeah, and online, if you just do Prairie Nurseries in Wisconsin, I think you'll probably find a couple of different sources. And start with Prairie Nursery. He's got excellent information on his website.
There's lots of good information on that website.
So that would be a place to do a little reading and research before you talk to anybody.
And good luck. Thank you for calling. Jessica in Jim Falls. Hi.
Good morning, Larry and Melinda. How are you today?
Great.
How are you doing, Jessica?
Wonderful. Happy Friday to you.
No, it's a great day.
To you as well.
Thank you. What prompted me to call you this morning was the statement that you had made previously about your classes that you were going to be having, and I heard you make the comment of bottle feeders. Is this correct?
Oh, we're doing terrariums
out
of water bottles. Out of recycled water bottles. But we also will have aqua cones there using 2-liter bottles to do watering devices. But you must have something in mind.
I have a specific question, actually.
Okay.
About 4 or 5 years ago, I had taken the time to save and clean these beautiful wine bottles.
Oh, yes.
And created them into to hummingbird feeders.
Excellent.
I had purchased some corks for the feeding tubes.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah,
of course, I handed them out as Christmas presents, and they all leak. So I was wondering if I have been unable to find any cork feeding tubes that will fit these wine bottles, and I was wondering if you had any suggestions for that.
You know, Birds and Blooms is supplying those. I have the back porch full of wine bottles too, with that in mind. So maybe I need to start shopping around to make sure I find those that fit. But you know, the best thing is you called in to the best resource there is, right, Larry? Hmm. Your listener.
That's right.
So, you know, I'm going to do some hunting, and we'll have some things at State Fair. They used old soda bottles. I'm trying to think. I saw the hummingbird feeders, and I have one in my basement, and I haven't used that particular one yet for hummingbirds. I'm just not home enough to really be good about the feeder. So I guess I'm just going to throw that question out to the listeners, if that's okay, Larry.
Yeah, absolutely.
A brand that works, because that's excellent. Those, and what a great Christmas gift, you know?
Well, it was until it leaked. Yeah, and my girlfriend had called, like, I couldn't figure out why my dog was all red. Well, here was hummingbird juice that the dog was, you know.
The gift that kept giving a little too much, right?
So I quit making them, but I have a gazillion bottles here that are just screaming at me to construct, but I refuse to do it until I find an actual cork that will to work. So if anyone out there has a recommendation, I am listening.
Well, thank you. And here's a couple of other things you can do with wine bottles. You can use them as an edge. So you turn them upside down, dig a trench, you know, good sand would be great, and use them as an edge where they're, you know, it's not going to be a breakage issue. We used them with plant nannies, which are terracotta spikes that you use your wine bottle, fill it with water, turn it upside down, and these spikes go in your containers. And the water moves from the spike through the terracotta into the surrounding soil.
Mm.
Yeah, and it's pretty. So for my Christmas gifts, I love to give wine too. So I give a bottle of wine, a plant nanny, and hand it out so they could drink the wine and then use the pretty bottle in their containers. Now, it's a small amount of water, so depending on the size of the container, you may need a couple. But it's a fun decoration as well.
Yeah.
I've seen rain chains. Now, in our area, you couldn't leave them out for winter. But I saw somebody make rain chains out of wine bottles that were really cool.
Rain chains.
Yeah. Light shades for outdoors. 10-watt bulbs, the most you can do. But you cut the bottom, you cut the bottom or the top off, and you can use them, or the bottom off, I think is how they did it. And then you had the light bulb in there, and they used that in outdoor lighting. That was very cool.
Mm. I was thinking about England. I don't know that we could do it in this climate, but they had buried the wine bottles, upside down in the soil so that just the top was showing, and it was a walkway in a couple of cases, or in another case, it was just a sitting or a bench was. They had I don't know, 100 of them placed in front of that bench, and so that was sort of the tile, quote, that you walked on.
Well, and you know, and one of the Dawn who works with me is trying that in her yard, so we will let you know in the spring.
Oh yeah, we were wondering if the heaving and all that.
That's what I was worried about too. So we thought we would. She's giving it a try, and that was one of my concerns. So I'll report back next spring. And I also saw this was in California. They did corks on end as walkways, so you know, or a mat or something like that, so you can put all of it to reuse in the garden. So the other thing I saw with corks at, I think it was the Philadelphia Flower Show, is they just took rings and filled them with corks. So you know, it didn't matter if it froze or whatever, and it was still drainage. So it's just something kind of a little fun and different. So.
And now the corks, you know, the cork is being replaced in a lot of wine bottles with a
synthetic plastic or whatever, rubber.
Rubber or something.
Yeah, so that would be even, you know.
And that is what these stoppers are made from.
So that's the problem.
Yeah, maybe that's it. We need to go back to the original cork.
Yeah, so maybe we'll have to all just have a few more glasses and send you the cork.
Yeah, cork is getting harder to get. That's why you're seeing it's, and it's expensive, so.
Okay,
well, let's see if we've got an answer from somebody listening in.
Great. Thank you so much. And this was a fun discussion. And these are kind of the things we're going to talk about at State Fair, too. So, you know.
Oh, perfect.
And I love, one of the things I love, just you learn so much from listeners and people who come to classes. And gardeners are so generous with sharing plants and ideas. It's great.
Thanks, Jessica.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. Thanks for the call.
Douglas in Fox Point. Hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Great, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, it seems that the only thing really blooming in my garden in this drought is the Canadian thistle.
Oh.
And it's just inundating my garden. I'm a fairly experienced gardener, but this is just driving me to wit's end on how to get rid of it. I'm sure it's a long-term process, but if you could point me in the right direction, I'd really appreciate it.
How do you feel about chemicals?
Better living through modern chemistry, really.
Okay. Well, I always like to start there rather than go with chemicals and then you go, I really didn't want to do it. Roundup painted on to the leaves.
Yeah.
And it may need several applications. I tried, I have an area next to my house, too, that I hit this summer because the thistles, I tried digging and I just couldn't keep up with them.
Right.
And so, and it's a mulched bed, so it's better than it was 3 years ago. So I don't have to use as much chemical because it helps suppress some of the seeds. But this hot, dry weather, thistles are thriving. Now, thistles are great for finches, use the seed and the fluff in their nest and a lot of butterflies nectar on them. So I want to make sure I cover that. But as a gardener, keeping them out of the garden, they can just take over. If you've got desirable plants, what you can do is cover the thistle. Take a milk jug, cut out the bottom, set it over. Yeah. If it's a small thistle, spritz with the total vegetation killer like glyphosate,
right,
like Roundup.
Yeah.
Or you can use, a gardener gave me this, he and his neighbor invented the tongs of death. I know, isn't that a gardener for sure? They took sponges and attached them to tongs they only use in the garden and then dipped them in the properly mixed Roundup, squeezed off the extra and wiped it on the leaves.
Okay.
And then his neighbor and I were going, well, and if you use the barbecue type, you get a longer reach. So it really reduces your chemical use because you're putting it just where you need it, and it helps you, I think, avoid the good plants. We've just had a couple. Last year was wet, followed by heat and drought. We've just had some good thistle growing years.
Yep.
And boy, once they get in your garden and set seed, you'll be able to get, if you can put a little time and energy and don't mind using, total vegetation killer. If you don't want to use chemicals for those out there, just continually cutting them at ground level. If you can't dig them out, you'll eventually starve them to death. Get it before they set seed. I think a combination of both is always a good idea. If you can pull the little ones, treat the ones that are out of control, and just keep after it. But it was so hot this summer, I think everyone was just watering.
Well, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and actually the other plant, I think we mentioned this on the show the other day, but Queen Anne's lace.
Oh
my goodness. Yeah, Queen Anne's lace is everywhere.
That and bindweed in the
bindweed, yes.
Dried gardens right now, it looks like a morning glory with a white bloom that fades to pale purple, and it's the one flower you could see in all the dormant lawns, and I'm like, oh man, and another tough one to get rid of.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thanks, Doug. Appreciate it. Good luck with that.
Thanks a lot for calling. Melinda Myers, our Milwaukee-based garden expert, author of more than 20 books. She's the host of Melinda's Garden Moments, our guest here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for listening into this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Melinda Myers. Melinda, we got an email from Rita in Madison who says, I have cucumber beetles this year, both striped and spotted on my cukes and squash, and it seems many people in my neighborhood on the north side have this problem as well, north side of Madison, worry about the spotted because of bacterial wilt, and I've been maintaining with organic insecticidal soap and hand picking, which is very hard since they're very fast. And they see you coming. Anything I can do this fall and next spring to help minimize this issue?
I don't have any research on this, but a fellow garden writer told me that it was kind of one of those, somebody told him, and it's something that's eco-friendly and safe, but covering your plantings with a floating row cover until they set bloom sometimes gets the plant up and growing and at least has them more vigorous so they can tolerate the feeding damage and hopefully if the bacterial wilt does move in. You're using eco-friendly products. Insecticidal soap is the least harmful on bees because they are, those cucumber beetles are not only on the leaves, they're on the flowers. So spraying things like permethrin is better than 7, but it's still an insecticide. There's really no good prevention that I know of, anything that you can do preventatively to prevent the feeding of these. I don't know, Larry, if you guys have talked about it with Phil. I just don't know of anything. I do remember one woman telling us between these, I think she was using a vacuum on these.
Yeah.
And just using a very light suction power to get these, or it was potato beetles, one or both of them. So, you know, that might be another way. Not the shot back on high power. You won't have any cucumbers. But, you know, that might be a way to speed things up. I don't, other than that, I really, Rita, I'm sorry, I don't know of any good way to prevent them. And,
no.
Continue with what you're doing, I think, is your best bet, and we'll hope for a good year for the cucumbers.
Yep, we certainly will do that. And I had an email from an Iowa farmer about some problems that he was having in his field, and I think rather than deal with that, I'm going to tell him to go to the insect diagnostic lab. If you go online to the insect diagnostic lab at UW-Madison, you can post a question there, and Phil Pelletieri has a lot of experience with insects and corn and can help you out there. So
yeah, and he is a great resource. We're so lucky to have him and Brian Huddleston, and those are my backups. When I can't answer it, I can shoot off an email, and they're some of the busiest people I know that are some of the kindest people to answer your questions, and their enthusiasm. If you hate bugs, Phil will convince you to like them, and Brian may get you to embrace aster yellows. Not love it like he does, but embrace it.
Oh, boy. We had an email from Will in Partyville who said, my apologies to Melinda for not following her advice.
Uh-oh, okay.
Last time she was on, you recommended that he pinch the early blossoms.
Mm.
I just couldn't make myself do it. So yesterday I ate a ripe yellow Dall watermelon, but the vine was so anemic that it produced only one melon. The flavor was flat. The melon was the size of a baseball. I'll do it better next time.
Well, you know what? And sometimes we all have to learn that way. And even though I know it's tough, I have to sometimes just, you know, I've gone, oh, and the next day gone out. And, yeah, I hear you. Apology accepted. We've all been there.
Oh, man. Joanna and Eau Claire, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi there. I have a question about a 100-year-old white spruce tree that suddenly this spring started looking quite ill. The lower underside branches stayed brown, and it did get new green growth above it, but just wondering if perhaps it has some sort of, I don't know, disease or mold or fungus or something that needs treatment, or if this is like part of a life cycle. Just really don't know what's going on.
Okay, a couple things I'm going to have you do is take a closer look. There are a couple of diseases that can cause the symptoms you described. First of all, spruce trees, as they get older, the upper branches shade the lower branches. So if you go to a tree that's even limbed to the ground, if you lift up those branches, often there are no branches starting until 8 feet up. You know, they've just kind of arched down.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just shade. So it's just nothing you can do. It's just all the shade from the upper branches shade out the lower ones, and so you'll have maybe needles on the end or the branch will be killed. Not a problem. Just prune those off. Cytospora canker is probably the most common disease I see. It won't kill the plant, but it disfigures it. You know, we have that nice Christmas tree-shaped spruce, and
mm-hmm.
it starts losing the lower branches and a few here and there. Inside, you'll see this kind of whitish-blue, milky-like substance on the trunk and the branches. That's a good clue. It's Cytospora canker. And most of my certified arborist friends would recommend, treatment's not really affected. The best thing you can do, mulch the soil underneath and make sure it gets good water during drought and prune off the dead branches, disinfecting your tools between cuts. And, you know, their feeling is you can do that, save your dollars for treatment, you can't do. So that's
mm-hmm.
Cytospora canker. Rhizosphera is a needle blight that also hits spruce, probably the second most common thing I see. You'll see little black dots on the needles before they turn kind of a purplish-brown and drop. You can treat that, but, you know, it's kind of, it's a big tree, lots of needle surface, and you'll need to get a professional to come in and treat it. That's usually a little quicker, can be life-threatening. Again, proper care is another way to manage that, to minimize the damage. So I take a closer look at those two things. On the extension site, there's good brochures on both of those diseases with photos.
Okay.
And I think that always helps you kind of take that picture out with you and go, oh, that looks like it or not that.
Sure. And what was that second one called?
Rhizosphera, and it's R-A, let's see, right, you know, it's one of those, I'm spelling it out here, R-H-I-Z-O-S-P-H-A-E-R-A, Rhizosphera, or luckily Google will correct you if I've misspelled
it.
Okay.
But those would be two things. The other thing I want to mention, and it's a relatively new tool for gardeners, and it's a plant strengthener. It's a new group of products that scientists found when plants are stressed, drought, insect disease problems, cold, heat, they produce certain molecules that boost their natural defenses. They isolated these and found that if they applied them on other plants, it helped those plants boost their defenses before problems occurred. So they're more drought tolerant, more... It won't kill the insect, it won't kill disease organisms, but it'll beef up the, it's like an immunization for the plants. And one of those, probably the most easily accessible one that I found is Jazz, like the music spray. And so the idea is it's just kind of, you can treat stress plants or use it preventatively. And it's one of those things, you water the soil, you know, in small plants, you can get it on the foliage, but it's just another tool that, you know, might be useful in that process of dealing with stress plants, especially this summer.
Okay, so Jazz Spray is the brand, name?
Yeah, it is. And it's Jasminate is the molecule, but yeah, so Jazz like the music spray.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling, Joanne. And Diane in Cold Spring, hi.
Hi.
Hi, Diane.
Thank you. I have a nut tree. It's a heart nut tree. It's kind of like a walnut. And I think it cross-pollinates because we had, when we bought them, we had to buy two. But the other one looks like a butternut. And it's very difficult to get the meats out of the butternut trees, but the heart nuts are beautiful. And my problem is I can't compete with the squirrels because they want the heart nuts and they don't like the butternuts either because they're too hard to crack. So I want to know if I have two trees planted and close enough together that the crowns touch, how do I keep the squirrels out of my tree?
Oh, boy. And, you know,
Boy,
somebody once said the reason we can't do a squirrel-proof bird feeder is those squirrels have all day to figure out how to get into a bird feeder. George Harrison, who does the bird part of Birds in Bloom, wonderful guy, ended up removing a tree. He did a video called Squirrel Wars. He's got every contraption you can imagine. A couple things you may want to try. You know, there's nothing that scares the squirrels in my yard. I'm on a busy street. My cats are indoor cats. They're afraid of the squirrels. So you could try noise. You could try squirting them with the garden hose if you're out there. You know, anything that might, you know, moving around, noisemakers, anything that could do that. Messina Animal Stopper has a squirrel stopper product. It's made of natural herbs. It smells good, so at least it won't stink. But, you know, treating a big tree may be challenging, but that might be an option. Cayenne pepper, but again, how do you get it on there? There's some hot
pepper. Tree.
Yeah, exactly.
Would putting something just around the
trunk?
The trunk work?
Yeah, I would try that animal stopper on the trunk and maybe some of your lower branches. It's Messina. They have an animal stopper, but they have deer stopper, rabbit stopper, cat stopper for those neighbors' cats that come wandering, and dog stopper and squirrel. They're all a different formulation. And you might give it a try. It smells good, which is quite unusual and very effective, they guarantee.
And I can get this where?
Garden centers, some hardware stores online as well. So you might want to call around at some big box stores. So it's Messina. I would do the squirrel stopper. And then, like you said, maybe try some of the, like the trunk where they're running up. And I would treat both trees and maybe some of the lower branches just to kind of give you added. Other than that, you know, motion sensitive, there's a thing called a mini scarecrow. but you have to get your neighbors to buy in, and it's, you can put it at any height, and an animal goes in front of it, and it puts out a thing of compressed air, and then a big, really loud. And then you turn the sound off eventually, because then they'll get the compressed air and supposedly know the sound is coming, but your neighbors may hate you by the time. The squirrels. And there are motion-sensitive sprinklers, too. I don't know how practical in a tree that would be with the leaves blowing and everything. So.
Squirrels are pretty much impossible to get rid of.
I can tell you've done battle, Larry.
I have done a lot of battle. And you even someone here in Madison trapped. I'll trap the ones out of my backyard. He wound up trapping 100. Because they just, you know, as soon as you trap one out, another one comes and takes its place. So.
Exactly. So you're, yes. So, and nobody wants them. So what do you do with them?
Well,
nobody wants them.
So there you are. Oh, man. Well, Melinda Myers is our guest today, Milwaukee-based garden expert, author of more than 20 books, and host of Melinda Myers Garden Moments, our guest here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, Friday means garden talk, and the drought has created a lot of questions. The rain, the recent rains, even in some ways created more questions. Melinda Myers, our Milwaukee-based gardening expert and the author of more than 20 books with us. Today, she's host of Melinda's Garden Moments. She has a great website at melindamyers.com. We have a link to it posted on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. With us until 12:30 today. And, of course, happy to answer your questions when you call or shoot us an email or post on my Facebook page. And, Melinda, we had an email from Carrie in Rock County with several tomato plants with full-sized, though small, tomatoes that are very green, been green for weeks, show no signs of ripening, seem to be taking much longer to ripen this year. Is this the case everywhere, or do I have some sort of issue with my plants?
You know, heat usually affects tomatoes and peppers in the blooming and the fruit formation. And so what we typically can see is extremely high temperatures. Peppers often drop their blossoms. Tomatoes just don't accept pollen and form fruit. Same goes in extremely low temperatures. With the heat, we typically see things ripening more quickly. I would probably check and make sure if they're small, truly small, to make sure that they were successfully pollinated and fertilized. They'd be pretty tiny if that was the case. In terms of ripening, I cut and see what's going on. Moisture is critical in terms of that, and it's really not much we can do but wait. But you may want to pick one and bring it inside, see if it ripens indoors, make sure you're watering properly. You would see other issues. I'm not hearing a lot of complaints like that. Most of the complaints are because of the hot weather, things haven't started forming fruit real readily. I picked my first ripe tomato. I never get the chance to brag about picking. I'm usually the last one because I'm planting so late. But I got a few in pots this year early and, you know, picked a couple, and the flavor was okay, but everything else is a little slow, and a lot of that's coming, I think, because we had such late fruit set because of the extreme heat. So it may just seem like it's taking forever for them to green, but it may actually be that they were setting a little bit later. So I would give them some time. If you can't wait, take one, maybe slice it open, see that it's fully and properly mature or, you know, formed inside, and then just wait. That's the hardest part of gardening, I think.
Yeah, I think so, too. Janice in Eau Claire, hi.
Hi, Janice.
Hi. I just wanted to comment about the potato bugs.
Yes.
Yes.
We had a bad potato bugs, and we picked them all off, and then we sprinkled, our friend told us to use crushed oyster shells.
Okay.
And we sprinkled them all over the plant, well, a little bit around, on the plant, and on the ground around the plant we sprinkled it, and the sharp edges, the potato bugs haven't been back.
Well, that's cool. That's good. One of the things to always try and why I always use research bases, you know, you do it, and was it a coincidence that you'd taken care of the problem and they wouldn't have come back anyway? And whether you're using a spray or one of these methods, as long as it's eco-friendly, environmental, just kind of monitor and see. So thank you for sharing.
Mm-hmm.
Jeff Gilman out of the University of Minnesota did a couple of good books where he's researched some of the home remedies and organic. I don't know if that's in his book, but he's a really fun author, a fun speaker, and you might want to check out. He's got great ideas. Things I didn't think would work, his research showed they did.
They did work, yeah.
Yeah, so thank you for that tip. I appreciate your sharing.
Thanks, Janice, for calling. Ann in Milwaukee, turn to you now. Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Ann.
Hello. I was inspired after going to the Secret Gardens of Tosa tour.
Oh, yeah.
Just always to die for. And I always come home, you know, excited to do something. Well, I decided to terrace one of my flower beds. So yesterday I started moving some of the plants. Luckily, I have some space to put them. But I've been nursing along some clematis, which, you know, take forever to really get blooming. What are my chances of them surviving if I transplant them? Because what I'm going to be doing is adding probably 18 inches of dirt along the fence, which, of course, is where the clematis are.
Okay.
So, you know, I'm thinking they wouldn't survive if I
buried them.
Dirt over them.
Yeah, I'd be a little nervous about covering the roots that much, too. If this is the time, part of gardening is, you know, I can tell you all the ideal things, but we all know we break the rules because, you know, the gas company's running a line. You know, this is when we have vacation. So if this is when you have to move it, you know, I think taking as much of the root system as you can manage and have space for in a big pot is going to increase your chance of success. You know, keeping it in a somewhat shaded area, especially with this heat we've been having, you know, at this point, you know, you just want to keep it alive and water, check it daily, you know, make sure you've got good drainage and, you know, getting it back in the ground when you're done and getting it reestablished will be your best bet. Or bury that pot for winter in a protected area if you're not quite done prepping that area and replanting. You know, clematis are pretty tough. You could also do some layering. This usually like to do that at the beginning of the season, but, you know, layering is just taking a long stem from a vine or like raspberries or roses, climbing roses, and you bend it, notch about 9 inches from the tip, bury that portion, put a little rooting hormone, bury that portion, but leave it attached to the parent plant. And then it will root, and then you have a new plant. So what you might be able to do is try to layer it as you're nursing it in the container and try to hedge your bet with, okay, I'm hopefully this main plant will make it, but maybe I can get a couple of new starts by layering as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I wish I could say yes for sure, but it's going to be a see how things go.
Yeah, it sure is.
Right. I usually figure if they make it, they make it. If they don't,
they weren't meant to be in your garden.
That's right. Exactly right, Ann.
I'm with you on that one.
Oh, you know, and Sandra in Madison emailed, she has viburnum, heptacodium, and a birch, also a new red bud, and she needs to move them.
Yeah.
And she's thinking because it's rained, she's tempted to strike while the ground is moist.
Boy, if you can wait and do it when they're dormant, yeah. And birch is typically, we like to plant birch in spring because they tend to be slow to root, just like the red buds. So if you can't wait till spring, fall after the leaves have dropped would be a safer time. We've all broken the rules and moved stuff, but with this, you know, they're talking about hot weather next week in some parts of the state, and boy, that's, you can plant, it's just tough on the plants. Transplanting's even more difficult. If you got to do it, proper post-transplant care is critical. If you can wait, yeah, I agree with you, Larry, after they're dormant in the fall or spring, even better.
Jolie in Cronenwetter, your turn. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Jody.
Hi.
I've got a question with pompous grass.
My
sister has pompous grass. My mother has pompous grass at her home, and I have, and it's just overtaking everything. And we've mowed it down, we've cut it down. I've got an area, I like where I've got it in a certain area, but of course it comes into the grass. But my sister would like to get rid of it. What is a way of getting rid of pompous grass?
Yeah, and for, you know, anybody from the South knows that Their pampas grass is a little different than what we call pampas grass up here. It's probably one of the Miscanthus sacrophloris. It tends to run and spread. There's also Erianthus, I think it's been renamed again, Saccharum, I think is the new genus that is really tall. Here's what, if you don't mind using chemicals, treating with a total vegetation killer to get the top and the root systems down. If you don't want to do that, edging, and if it's just grass in that area, edging the bed, covering it. Believe it or not, clear plastic is even better than black plastic because you cook it, the tops and the roots, or black plastic to, you know, prevent the sunlight from getting it. But you need to edge the bed because any of those stems outside can feed the plants underneath. Continual tilling, if you don't keep up with it, you're propagating it. So, you know, total vegetation killer is probably going to be the easiest. Read and follow label directions. Suffocating it with plastic is an option. You know, edging the bed where you want to keep it and then treating the stray plants that encroach into the garden. You know, if you edge it, then it won't move that chemical into the main planting is another way to keep it kind of contained for you, but your sister will probably want to treat the whole planting to get rid of it all.
Yep.
Okay.
There you go.
Okay. Good luck. You'll need it. And be persistent.
I think the tassel is beautiful.
Oh, yeah.
I take it to people to put it in for, you know, a decoration and stuff, but it's just...
It just goes
Yeah, and there's
wild.
Some, you know... Mary Hockenberry Meyer out of the University of Minnesota has a booklet, and I think most extension offices here carry it, called Ornamental Grasses for Cold Climates. And there are some Miscanthus that are clumpers and non-invasive, and she evaluates them for cold hardiness for zone 3 she just started and 4, as well as 5, and then invasiveness. And it's a reasonable price, some color photos, but good information. So it's Ornamental Grasses for Cold Climate by Mary Hockenberry Meyer, M-E-Y-E-R. And I think the extension offices here used to carry it. Otherwise, you could get it online.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Good luck. Thanks for the call.
Gail in Marion, hello to you.
Hi.
Hi, Gail.
Hi. I just planted several knockout roses this spring.
Sure.
And they're really blooming, going great guns.
Excellent.
Now I'm wondering for the fall, how far down or where do you cut to make a nice winter protection for those? And what kind of mulch is good to use for roses?
Now, here's what with knockout roses, designed to be nice and winter hardy, central part of the state, sometimes they'll die back to the ground and come up from that. Leaving them stand for winter increases hardiness. Okay. I'm really designed not to need winter protection. If you do feel you need to, you can, but leaving them stand for winter. You know, let them flower out and form rose hips in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
I don't deadhead mine. I have one of the original ones in my front yard, and I don't deadhead mine, and I get blooms almost all season nonstop. And I leave it stand for winter.
Well, you do.
Yeah, I've had a couple years where I've had a little dieback. But waiting, in fact, one year I thought, oh, I lost it. So I have a double knockout now next to it, because when I went to plant the second one, the other one was coming back. It was like the second week of June. So now I have two knockout roses in my front yard.
Cool.
So, yeah, so be patient in the spring. If we have a really tough winter and a cool, wet spring, it may be slow to come back. Then just prune out the dead growth. I find with shrub roses, removing old dead stems, the bigger, fatter ones, to the ground after a few years, and then any death on the tips is really your best bet. You'll have a stronger, sturdier, healthy plant, stiffer stems, and more winter hardy.
Okay. Thank
All right.
you.
Thanks.
Enjoy.
Thanks a lot for calling. And turn to Brad now in Chippewa Falls. Hi, Brad.
Hi, Brad.
Hello. Hello. How are we doing today?
Great. How are you?
Good. I have a question with a birch tree that I have. It's loaded with little silverish green and blue beetles, and they're stripping it bare from the top down. Is there something I can do to get rid of them? This is the second year I've noticed it.
Yeah, it's not the Japanese beetle, correct? Do you know that? Are you familiar with Japanese beetle? They're kind of coppery green.
Are they bright green?
Yeah, it might be. Well, yeah, they're like a luminescent when you...
Yeah, that could be the Japanese beetle.
Yeah, the Japanese beetle love birch and
yes.
lindens. And
yeah.
And I'm not a fan of traps because you can bring them in. Your neighbors might appreciate it, but you can bring them in. There's a product, it won't help this year, but you may want to treat next year, a tree and shrub insecticide with imidacloprid as the active ingredient. Bayer is one brand. You know, if you find theirs, you can probably find if there are others nearby. You put it in the soil. It's absorbed by the plant. And then when the beetles eat on it, that'll knock them down. Permethrins, which are a synthetic form of pyrethrins, will work, but boy, you've got to get good coverage, you know, and it's really tough to control. Olbrich Botanic Garden just uses physical, you know, the volunteers and staff occasionally go out and knock the beetles into soapy water. You know, you're not going to get control on the high branches, but, you know, you'll reduce the populations to some extent. What I remember hearing, I think it was on your show, Larry, from Phil, or maybe from you, that what they're seeing is areas that had high populations in the past were seeing a little bit of a decrease.
Decline, yes.
But in some areas where they're newly being infected, a little higher population. So the imidacloprid you can put in the soil, a fall treatment will help with the borer and leaf miner, as well as the Japanese beetle. If you're doing it next spring, at least 20, preferably 30 days before they come out. And that's usually July. Though this year I saw them in June because of the warm, mild winter. And keep the tree in good health is your best bet. A healthy tree can tolerate, but birches struggle in our, you know, struggle in our landscapes, as do some of the lindens with some of the other problems they're having. So might be worth treating.
Yep, absolutely.
Now, will they eventually kill the tree, or?
Well, probably not one year. If you've been able to water during the drought, if you've got the roots mulched, you know, the paper birches like cool, moist soils, and we're seeing them struggle with this heat that we've been having and the drought. The Japanese beetles typically 1 year wouldn't kill them, but repeatedly over time and with the other stresses in the environment and the risk of bronze birch borer.
Yeah, that's what happens. It gets weakened, and then the bronze birch borer comes in.
Exactly. So that's why we really treat the paper bark birch and the linden, because of the linden borer as well, and they've really been suffering lately. So that kind of, for them, that's why I recommend treating those. And I'm usually pretty low about treating for Japanese beetles, but for those two plants, it's more than just aesthetics. It's the long-term health and vigor of that.
Mm-hmm.
So you might want to put it on your calendar either this fall or next spring to treat so that you can keep those under control.
Thank you for calling.
Thank you very much.
Okay, good luck with that.
And you can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. We'll get you on pretty quickly. We got open lines. I've been forgetting to mention the number, so I mentioned it now. 1-800-642-1234. Email from Pat in La Crosse. Notice that a few of my coneflower plants have developed a very strange mutation-like flower along with the natural or the normal blooms. They are very spiky and a brilliant lime green.
I'm glad you asked this question because I have been seeing a lot of this too. It's aster yellows. In fact, I saw so much that I sent a picture to Brian Huddleston and said, am I diagnosing this? Is this all aster yellows? And he said, yeah, a lot of it around the state. It's a phytoplasm, a bacterium-like organism that what happens, it's carried by the aster leafhopper. So a leafhopper feeds on an infected plant, the one with the funky-looking leaves and flowers, and then takes it to a healthy plant. And when they're sucking the plant juices, they inject this phytoplasm, and that's how it's spread. It won't kill your plants, but the reason we recommend removing infected plants is it's a source of disease to infect other plants. Controlling the leafhoppers with insecticidal soap reduces the spread. It doesn't cure the disease. It just reduces the spread. So, it's really bad. We have some at State Fair. I think we left some purposely, you know.
Yeah.
These plants are a good thing for me to show you what it looks like. We saw some at the Botanic Garden, you know. So it's out there. Hot, dry weather, great for leafhoppers. And so we're seeing a fair amount of that. So, you know, minimally cut off the infected stems. You may want to remove the plant or just, you know, definitely control leafhoppers. They're those little bugs when you touch the plant, they hop sideways. So, but your plants will survive. It's just a source of disease for other ones.
Yeah. Sarah in Appleton planted 14 medium-sized cedars this spring. They were green and healthy, watered the first month. then sort of every now and then. And about 2 weeks ago, they started turning yellow-brown almost overnight.
Yeah, and you're probably thinking the same thing I am, Larry. With this hot, dry weather, it takes at least 2 years to establish trees and shrubs, and we don't think about that because, you know, and we usually, whatever usual weather is here, have rain. You know, it's been a while since we've had such an extensive drought, but really it's important that first season, even the second year, watering thoroughly, less frequently, but, you know, when the top 4 to 6 inches are crumbly and moist, give it a good soaking. I do some work with a garden center, and they Stein was joking about if you buy 20 arborvitae, we ought to give you a soaker hose just to make sure you water them, because really that's where they're seeing the returns on plants. And what I see talking to gardeners, I understand it's hard to take care of everything in your yard. And so it sounds like a drought stress. And what happens with evergreens, they kind of can die before showing the symptoms.
Right.
You know? So I think it's the heat and the drought and the occasional but not regular watering that probably took them out this year, I'm afraid.
Shelley in Waterford has a question for you. Hi, Shelley.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I live in a wooded area where we have a variety of trees, but some of what we have are oak trees, and some are very old, well-established trees, and some are younger. But what we've started to notice over the last couple years is that there will be like a couple branches on a tree that will have very light-colored leaves, and I'm wondering if we're starting to get some kind of a disease hitting our oaks or what that might be.
You know, you may want to get a certified arborist out. Chlorosis is a common problem, especially on white oaks. Sometimes you'll see it on red oaks. They don't like the sweeter alkaline soil, and so it's a problem with pulling up the iron and manganese out of the soil. Now, sometimes a change in the environment, construction damage, change of grade where soil's piled over the roots, moisture issues. You know, with the drought, we're seeing some nutrient deficiency because there's just not water to pull it up. Oak wilt typically is a wilting at the top, a flagging where the leaves hang down. Anthracnose, the leaves get brown spots, usually at the bottom. And we may see some powdery mildew, but, you know, oaks can be such long-term giants and beauties of the landscape. You know, I'd recommend getting a certified arborist out to take a look at your plants or contacting them. They've gone through a voluntary certification program to show a certain level of knowledge. Look for those that belong to the Wisconsin Arborist Association or International Society of Arboriculture because it shows they keep up to date. I think it would be worth investing to have them come and take a look at your trees, especially since you've been noticing this decline over time. And they can help you maybe stop whatever's going on or take care of it versus me guessing over the phone.
Yeah, you need somebody to see it.
Okay, thank you very much.
You bet. Good luck with those, and it's worth the effort for the next generation to preserve them. So thank you for doing that.
Yep, absolutely. Thanks so much. And Melinda, thank you so much. Again, you're lots of things to see on your website.
Yes, and please, we've had a little glitches on there, so if you don't get through the first time, please bear with us. I just sent a note to my provider to fix it, so try a second time. But, there's audio, video tips, my events. I'll be at State Fair at We Energy, Energy Park every day. I'm talking about garden renewal and love to visit with your listeners, Larry, and talk gardening.
Absolutely, and it's every and what time? What are the times?
I'm on at 9:45 in the morning and 2:00 in the afternoon. Kids activities at 11:15, and then I'm also doing the floral challenge. I'm moderating that on August 4th at noon in the Horticulture Building, and a fun repurposed runway mini fashion show.
Ooh!
So that's going to be Tuesday through Thursday, so I think that's the 7th through the 9th, at 3:30 at the Jeffrey Scott Stage Expo Center. So see some creative fashions made of recycled items. So I'll be the hot one that's been in the garden talking about the beautiful fashion, not looking fashionable.
Melinda, thanks. Melinda Myers, our guest. Thank you for listening. Stay with us.